Well, I want to start because I think we've got to put economics on trial. Mainstream economics, the theoretical foundation of mainstream economics is that individuals pursuing their own self-interest on the market, in the market, will lead to a situation of the greatest welfare for society as a whole. And I charge that this is false, it has misled the people, that it has ruined our entire world. And don't just take my word for it. My evidence for this is a striking passage from the United Nations Development Programme Annual Report of 2006, where they said, and I quote, it's burned into my brain, "Ours is a world of extremes. The poorest 40% of the world's population controls 10% of the world's income, while the richest 5% control 56% of the world's income. Never before has it been possible to eradicate poverty in our time. There are no longer any insurmountable technical, resource or logistical obstacles to achieving it. Yet, more than 800 million people go hungry or malnourished. 1.1 billion people do not have access to safe, clean drinking water, and every hour 1,200 children die of preventable diseases." The idea that a minority of people pursuing their own self-interest has created welfare for society as a whole, I think, is completely disproved by these startling facts. We've had 200 years of capitalism, and this has been the result. But the second objection that I think we have to say, this was 2006, because the second thing that is a stalwart fundamental theme of mainstream economics is that the market, left to its own devices, will efficiently allocate resources throughout different sectors of the economy and provide for the needs and well-being of the majority of people. My evidence against this is the global financial crisis, which erupted in 2008, where the entire financial sector of the US and half of the European financial sector collapsed in upon itself as a result of the market working in its efficient form. And one of the world's formerly most powerful bankers, Alan Greenspan, at the time of this massive collapse, he announced, "I have found a flaw," as though nobody else noticed. You know? And he says, "I don't know how significant it is." Well, it's fairly significant. But he went on to say, he was pulled up in front of, I think it was a congressional or Senate committee hearing in the United States. They're trying to figure out what the hell went wrong here. And he says, "Well, I'm in a state of shock disbelief. The modern risk management paradigm that you leave banking, lending institutions to pursue their own self-interest, that will protect shareholder equity." He says, "The complete intellectual edifice collapsed in the summer of last year." That was in 2007. So even the world's biggest, most powerful, formerly most powerful banker can see that something does not work in the system that they've been defending for so long. So, well, begs the question, if mainstream economics is fundamentally flawed and doesn't work, well, what is the difference between this and Marxist economics? Because isn't Marxist economics, or isn't economics really, isn't all just about the share prices, the stock indices, interest rates, inflation, all that sort of stuff? Well, I'm going to argue that no, Marxist economics is fundamentally different to mainstream economics in that Marxist economics takes its starting point from the fact that before human beings can come to grips with what economics is, before we can think about the world, participate in any aspect of social life, there's one prerequisite that needs to be fulfilled, and that is that we need to be alive. You can't come to grips with the world if you don't actually exist. Now, sounds somewhat ridiculous, but it's important because mainstream economics takes it as a standard fact, and they just move on, and human existence is an assumption. Marxist economics doesn't start from the assumption. It starts from the fact of how we actually organise ourselves in society to keep ourselves alive. So Marxist economics is fundamentally about the relationships that people enter into to provide the things that we need to stay alive: food, clothing, shelter, etc. So Marxist economics isn't just about interest rates, money, those sorts of things. Although, of course, when you get into it, they do figure. But first and foremost, it's about how human creativity, how our energies to change the world are developed. How do we exist? To what ends do we direct our energies? And how does the world that we create come back and impact upon ourselves? These are fundamentally economic questions, I would argue. And this is why the study of economics, or Marxist economics, I think is vitally important, because really, if we're talking about, as this whole weekend has been, talking about how we change the world, well, fundamentally, you have to understand, if you want to change the world, you have to understand how the world works and how capitalism works. That's really what Marxist economics is about. Now, there's a lot to talk about in this particular subject area, but I'm going to keep it fairly brief and start with what is the cornerstone of Marxist economics, and that is the labour theory of value. Now, the labour theory of value is a theory of the total value, or wealth, if you like, that's created in society as a whole. And this theory, the labour theory of value, is really the cornerstone, and everything else in Marxism, I would argue, flows from it. Our analysis that revolution is not just possible but necessary rests fundamentally on this theory. So it's a very important one. So let me briefly outline it. Now, when we think about value, about something being valuable, at first glance, it appears that value is the property of certain things. So, for example, if you go into a shop and you see an item on display, it'll have a price tag on it. A price tag expresses the exchange relationship between that particular object, maybe it's a chair, and some other object, money. So value seems as though it's a relationship between particular things. And this is how mainstream economics actually views it in general as well. But the question that arises once you've had a look at this is, how is it that objects that have completely different properties, how is it that we can compare them in a quantitative sense? How is it that things that have nothing alike whatsoever can be compared and exchanged? So, well, and more fundamentally than that, what is it that provides the basis for the systematic exchange of goods on the market all around the globe? So, for example, if we know that a leather couch costs $1,000 and a computer also costs $1,000, you don't have to be a genius to be able to say, well, look, they're worth the same amount. They have the same value. But it's perplexing, though, then, when you put them next to each other, you can say, well, they've got the same value, so they can be exchanged. But what is it about them that makes them exchangeable? They're different shapes. They're different colours. They're made from different materials. They're different sizes. They have completely different uses. You don't buy a computer and then just walk around and just sit on it when you want to watch television. And you don't play Nintendo with a couch. Like, clearly, they have different things. There's actually nothing physically or useful that's similar about them. So what is it then that allows them to be exchanged? Well, the answer to this is that despite all these physical differences, they have a common social quality. And that is the fact that they are the products of human labour. That both things have been laboured upon by human beings. And the fact that hundreds of millions or billions of commodities are traded and exchanged in the global market every week is possible by the fact that they've all been laboured upon. This is what gives them their commonality, their value. So if you take the example of one of the most valuable and sought-after items on the market, which is a diamond, really. You see ruling class figures swanning around with diamonds. They've got diamond rings, diamond chains, got them in their ears, walking around, swanned up, you know, very powerful. It seems like the diamonds have a power of themselves. People are mesmerised by them. Have you seen my diamond rings? Look at them, everyone's like, oh, the diamond rings, wow, aren't they amazing? But actually, the diamonds don't have any power. Well, in one sense they do, but what gives them their power? What gives them their value? Well, you take your mind to the diamond mines, particularly in places like Africa, where you've got thousands of young black African men who are sweating day in, day out, breaking their backs, bleeding from blisters, exerting all their energy. You take this exertion, this physical output of all these people, and you squeeze it into this tiny rock, and that's what gives the thing its value. So value isn't this thing of just objects. It's actually a social quality that gets given a material form through a labouring process. So the foundation for this relationship of exchange of all these goods going all around the world is the labour of different people in different industries all across the world. The act of exchange, then, is simply the comparison of general average labour times of all these objects. Now, the peculiar thing about capitalism is not just that search for value and the creation of value, is that value itself comes to dominate every aspect of human society and every aspect of our lives. So in other societies, you think that production is carried on for some human need, for use rather than exchange. So the working population, whatever it is, they produce things because it's going to, they produce them directly for consumption, both their own consumption and maybe the consumption of a ruling class. What mattered most in all other societies was the use of the thing, not its actual value. You made a table because people needed a table, shoes because people needed shoes on their feet, and food because people need to eat. Now, thank you. So whatever the nature of all these pre-capitalist societies, generally speaking, production is for some human need. Now, you might say at this point, well, what's changed? Because surely we produce things now for human need. Surely we produce shoes because people need to wear shoes and when they walk around so they don't get their feet cut by glass. Surely we produce chairs so we can have a conference like this, everyone can sit down more comfortably, we don't all have to stand up and, you know, people can't see past each other and those sorts of things. Well, actually, that's not the case. In capitalism, the value of something is much more important than the use, and it takes precedent. An example of this, you can think of many examples, but one example of this is food. Now, like, if you're hungry and you haven't eaten all day and you walk into a supermarket and you say, look, you're the manager of the supermarket, look, I haven't eaten all day. You mind if I take a bun? Well, do you think they're going to give you the bun? No, he's going to say, show me the money. If you've got swathes of people in Africa who don't have anything to eat most of the time. Maybe they write a letter to an agribusiness firm or to a farmer saying, sorry, dear sir, we hear that you create and grow plenty of potatoes. This is very fortunate because we are very hungry. Please send us some. Now, does the farmer or the agribusiness firm say, well, this is fantastic. This is what we've been growing all the potatoes for. Now we've got some use for them. No, of course they don't say this, do they? They say, show me the money. Same thing in housing. If people were here in the introductory session, the opening session, the opening night, Ashley Smith was talking about 17 million empty homes in the United States and 800,000 homeless people. Now you think the banks that own all the houses, do they say, well, this is fantastic. We've got to eradicate homelessness for at least 3 or 4 generations. That's not their response. Their response is, oh, God, we've got too many houses. What are we going to do about this? We've got to bulldoze them. Why? Because the answer is show me the money. They don't make the houses for people to live in. They make them so that they can create money off them, so that they can get the value out of them back in their pockets. And this shows something. If money can't be made out of any commodity, then human beings will go out, even if they desperately need that particular item. That's the way the capitalist system works. So the priority is the creation of wealth, not the satisfaction of need. And you see here that the domination of value over the use of a thing. And this is fundamental to our system. Now, one of the keys to seeing the differences between Marxist economics and mainstream economics is that mainstream economics is generally obsessed with the market itself. Its starting point is the realm of exchange. And this is precisely because mainstream economics is interested in the value and, you know, getting it in people's pockets and who can make the most money and making the models to see who's going to get ahead in the next round of economic growth and things like that. Marxist economics, however, despite the fact that I have started with the realm of exchange to illuminate some things about the nature of society, Marxist economics starts with production. And not just because of the things that I said, that, you know, before we can engage in anything, we have to be alive, so we have to produce things. We start with the process of production precisely because it's in this sphere that value is created. So if we want to understand the workings of the system, we actually have to look at what goes on at the site of the production of the objects and the value itself. So, the thing that's distinctive about the capitalist system is it involves the separation of the working population, like anyone who works, separated from the tools, the instruments, the means through which we could provide for ourselves in the immediate sense of being able to, you know, create our own clothing, our own shelter, our own food and those sorts of things. So because of this, the only way for working people to access the means of survival, the food, the clothing, the shelter, is through having money. Now, the only way to have money is to sell something. But the only thing we have as working people to sell is our capacity to labour. So, what does that mean? It means that for the vast majority of people in the world, we are compelled by necessity to submit to what is a social relationship of domination and oppression in a workplace, whereby a boss gives us the money we need and in return takes control of our very existence for a certain number of hours in the day, be that 6, 8 or 10. Now, what goes on in this number of hours? Well, firstly, we produce things. We produce enough things so that the boss can go and sell them. And this gives us our money at the end of the week.
Or the fortnight.
Or the fortnight.
All right.
Do it again. But that's not it. That's not all, is it, though? Because the boss doesn't just give us our money and say, great, you've created $500 worth of stuff for me. Here's your $500. No, no, that doesn't happen. The boss says, well, you've produced all these things, maybe producing shoes. You produce all these shoes, I've gone and sold them for $1,000. I give you $500 in your wages, and I'll keep the rest. That'll pay my rent. That'll buy my food. That'll pay for the electricity in this place and allow me to reinvest in some more machinery for my shoe company. So what's happened here? Exploitation has happened. Now, it's important to see here, exploitation is a scientific term. Exploitation is a process whereby a worker does not get paid in full the value that they create for somebody else. And it's important to see that because often exploitation, you know, it's used generally as a moral category. Like someone's exploited. It's because, you know, you feel like you're not getting paid the same as everybody else, or you're overworked, or you get treated like shit, taken advantage of in the workplace. Maybe you're forced to work unpaid hours or things like that. But in this sense, exploitation happens to all workers, regardless of how much they get paid, regardless of the job they're in. Exploitation, if you are a worker, by definition, you're exploited. It simply means you don't get paid the full amount that you create. So generally, workers get paid an amount that is enough to survive for the week, but necessitates coming back to submit to that relationship of domination again. And that week after week, day after day, month after month, year after year. So if you go back to Africa, again, we go back to the diamond mines. You don't see all the young black African men walking around with all the diamonds that they've just got in their chains, in their hair, or, you know, walking around them, falling out of their pockets. Of course not, because what they create is lost to them and taken by the employer. They get paid just enough that allows them to feed themselves, probably very poorly, maintain themselves in shelter, but so they have to come crawling back day after day to do the same job over and over again till their backs break and they get replaced by somebody else who can do the job more quickly than them. And probably only a few years, given the intensive labour in an industry like that. So just as we're separated as workers from the means through which we produce, the means that produce the things that we need, works are also separated from the things that are produced. So there's a double separation. Now, this exploitation that we're talking about, it isn't just a result of greed or poor character on behalf of a boss or the capitalists themselves. Because just as a worker has no choice but to go and be exploited if we're to survive, a capitalist, the boss, has no choice but, if they are to be a capitalist, but to exploit. Because if they don't exploit their workforce, then they don't have any profits, which means they go out of business and they get taken over by somebody else. So the reason for this is that obviously capitalism is a competitive system. So all the businesses are competing against each other for the value that does exist. And those companies that don't compete the hardest are the ones that will go out of business. So exploitation then is a mechanism through which both the working class as a whole manages to survive, but also it's the mechanism through which bosses end up surviving. So it's the foundation of the system itself. Now it's important to see that none of this is because of the decisions that individual people make. And I think this is important when thinking about changing the world and the way economics works. Because I said at the start, you know, the foundation, the fundamental ideological foundation of economics being that individuals pursuing their own self-interest on the market creates welfare for society, the greatest welfare for society as a whole. There's a political corollary to this ideologically, and that is that, well, individuals themselves, through their own choices, through their own decisions, can have an impact on changing the world. It's important to see, though, that under capitalism, human activity as a whole, regardless of the decisions people make and what they think about the world and their consumer choices, for example, all of this is dominated by the creation and appropriation of value on a world scale and by these social relationships of domination. Human activity as a whole is subordinated to the value which is the creation of human activity. And there's no way of thinking about it that changes that situation. Now, what does this state of affairs lead to in practice? Well, to stay in business, a capitalist has to accumulate more and more value. This is, you know, business 101. You've got to produce more goods more cheaply. And a state, well, the way this happens is that they invest, generally speaking, invest in machines. The purpose of a machine is to change the labour process so that the products that are the result of the labour process contain less value in them, i.e. that they can be sold then more cheaply. So machines either serve to get rid of labour, individual labourers, and you think, you know, if you're in an open-cut mine, at one point in time you had a lot of people with wheelbarrows or pulley systems. Nowadays you have one person with a ginormous truck. There's a machine that decreases the amount of labour that goes into the product. Or for those of us who have had the misfortune of working in call centres, those horrible auto dialers, which, you know, just speed up the rate at which you make calls because you can't actually control when you're going to make a call. It just keeps dialing and you just have to keep talking to whoever's going to answer the bloody phone at the end and, you know, ask some questions that they don't give a shit about and you don't really want to hear the answers to either. Yet every capitalist, though, is trying to do this. You know, more goods more cheaply through investing in machines. Now, the first boss that does this obviously gets a tremendous advantage. It's good for them. Because if you're the first boss to invest in the machines like an auto dialer, you can then go and say, get a call centre contract and say, look, I can make 1,000 calls per hour with 10 people and we can do it for the same prices. This other company doesn't have auto dialers who can only do 800 calls an hour with the same amount of people. So that's good for you as an individual boss. The problem, though, is a contradiction in capitalism. And by contradiction, I mean a state of affairs which leads to conflict or breakdown. That what's good for one is actually damaging to all. It leads to a situation where, over time, the amount of profit, the amount of value that capitalists are able to accrue as a proportion of the amount they have to invest, tends to decline. Now, it's not the total amount of profit gets smaller. It's just that in order to make a certain amount of profit, they have to invest larger and larger amounts of money in the beginning. This is actually the main contradiction in capitalism. It's that the pursuit of profit tends to lead to a decline in the rate of profit. And I'm not going to go into this too much because it's actually quite technical. But to point out two things, I guess. One, what is the technical side of it? Well, if we see, it flows from the labour theory of value, that labour is the only source of value, but through the process of competing with each other, capitalists are compelled to decrease the amount that they spend on labour in comparison to the amount they spend on machinery, which means that the value-producing section of their total outlay declines as a proportion of their total investment. That's the technical side of it. I won't go into it too much because if you want to understand it really, you just got to do a bit of serious reading on it. And we've got some good books that can guide to that that you can purchase and read. But by way of analogy, I guess, to describe how the situation works, if you picture a bank which year after year, gives you less interest on your savings account. So the first year, say, it's paying 20%, that's a good amount of interest, 20% of interest on your savings account. So the first year you go, you put $100 in the bank, end of the year, no brainer, you come out with $120. So you made $20. The next year, however, the bank's paying 10% interest. So there's two things that can happen. You can invest $100 again and come out with $110, i.e. half the amount of profit, or you can double your investment at the beginning to $200 and come out with the same amount. Third year goes down to 5%, and then you either have to quadruple your initial investment to get the same $20, or you get only a quarter of that which you put in. This is generally what happens to what happens in a capitalist economy over time. Now, there are things which mitigate against it, but it's a general trend, and it's simply the result of this pursuit after value. So the lower this rate of profit goes, though, the more difficult it becomes to make profit. And the result of this is that you see more bankruptcies. Companies can't keep up. The system as a whole becomes more unstable. Bosses start to attack workers and, well, they attack them more and more to make up for the fact that their system's failing them. So there becomes a huge pressure in the system which leads to conflict. And not just between workers and bosses with wage cutting, job losses, shortening of hours or speed ups, or the strikes that occur in response to those things, but between bosses and bosses, where you get the bankruptcies, where you get hostile takeovers of firms, and ultimately armed conflict that can break out between rival blocks of capitalists who want to push the costs of their declining system onto each other. So that's the important thing, that the lower the rate of profit goes, the more unstable the system as a whole becomes. And in terms of, to conclude, so in terms of looking at this, in terms of looking at the way the world is today, and, for example, the financial crisis, there's a really good argument and evidence to show that if we start from the fact that there has been this over time increase in the amount that's been invested in machinery compared to labour, we've had a declining rate of profit that occurred for a period of time from the 1960s, led to a period where it became much more difficult for workers, for bosses to make profits out of their workforce. This becomes the basis for all the attacks that we've seen over 30 years, particularly in the United States against the working class, the attacks on health and education systems, the lowering of corporate taxes across all the Western industrialised world so that bosses can keep making or attempt to make the same amount of profit in different ways. And that has led to this situation where we see us, where we find ourselves now, a situation where we have a general stagnation in the system, a financial collapse because people thought that it was easier to make money through speculating than through investing in genuine productive activity because they felt that they couldn't make the same sort of returns out of it. We have to see, though, out of all this, because all this, the big picture of what goes on in the economic world today is awfully confusing. And it's confusing, I think, precisely because mainstream economics presents us a world that is utterly distorted. The world that we see is distorted because we don't have control over any of the products of our labour. We don't have control over the productive process. So the theory that has to explain this world has to be a theory which is distorted and not particularly understandable as well. That's the reason why, like, if anybody's opened up an economics textbook, it seems very difficult. But actually, some of these things get shown to be very simple. It's the social relationships of capitalism that you take as a starting point that create the giant contradiction. And as I said, to conclude, again, I think I've said that already, but to conclude, you can't just think about these things in a different way. You can't educate people out of it. You can't just elect people to Parliament and think that things are going to change, because fundamentally, these social relationships of worker and boss, the process of value creation and the stealing of, you know, the value from the workforce as a whole, this goes on regardless of what people think about it, regardless of how educated people are, regardless of who's in Parliament. All of that stays fundamental. And you think, has anybody heard of Anthony Robbins, the motivational speaker in the United States? He's always trying to convince people they can change their lives if only they think about the world differently. And like Anthony Robbins, like if you picture him, and I'm going to do an impersonation of him now. If you picture Anthony Robbins coming in to talk to somebody about what's wrong with their life, he's always getting on to people like, "What's your problem, man? You know, what's keeping you back? What do you think's holding you down?" You picture a guy standing there sort of going, "You know, it's like, it's gravity, you know, it holds me down, it really sucks, you know, it's terrible." And you know, Anthony Robbins would say to somebody, "You know, you got to think outside of gravity, man. Don't let gravity define you. You got to dream, believe, achieve." Well, actually, it's the same thing with economic laws. You know, it's like gravity. Just in the way, like, as though if you thought about gravity differently, you're going to float away into the stratosphere. The same thing is, you can't think or educate ourselves out of this system because the social laws assert themselves through the genuine process of production. And all these social relationships are independent of and prior to whatever anybody thinks of them. Now, that's important. The only way to alter the state of affairs. To alter the drive which puts value in its creation above the needs of humanity is to alter the social relationships of production. That is, to get rid of the capitalist class and institute a system of democratic planned economy where the economy does not control us, but where we control what we produce in a planned fashion and in a way that puts human need rather than value creation worth first. This is why understanding Marxist economics is important, because it shows us a way of the way forward for how you can actually change the world. It shows us the real situation that's behind the poverty and the war that exists today. And above all, it shows us that revolution isn't just, and this is really the fundamental thing of why Marxist economics is vitally important and why the labour theory of value is the most, you know, the cornerstone of everything the Marxists say. Because it shows that revolution isn't just a good idea or something that we should strive for. It shows that the system itself grinds into situations which push people into action. It creates a crisis which enables us to begin to fight back and hopefully then overturn the existing social order and create the one that I mentioned just a minute ago. So I'll stop there.